Good morning. I call the House Education Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, February 23rd, 2026, and the time is 8:04 a.m. Apologies for the late start. Happy Monday. Members present are Representative Dybert, Representative Schwanke, Representative Eichscheid, Representative Underwood, and myself, Co-Chair Himshute. We have a quorum to do business. I would like to remind members to please silence your cell phones. We're in the Betty Davis Committee Room 106 in the State Capitol Building here in Juneau, Alaska. And the documents for today's meeting have been distributed to members, are available on the table outside the door and on basis. I'd like to thank our recording secretary, Cale Brown, and our moderator from the Juneau LIO, Jude Augustine, and our superhero committee aides, Tammy Smith and Ella Lubin. And on today's agenda, we have a whole bunch of things going on today. We're going to start with our first celebration of schools. There's so much to celebrate across the state. We want to start off today with celebrating something out of my home district, and then I'm hoping you all will bring something innovative or something that just really shines a light on the great things happening in your schools at home. At some point in the future, we will make room for that. And then after that, we're going to do House Bill 240 related to cyberbullying and AI, House Bill 261 related to education funding, and House Bill 246 related to the Special Education Service Agency. This is the initial hearing for both House Bill 240 and House Bill 246, and we will hear invited and public testimony on both bills. Slide decks and supplemental materials have been posted on basis, and printed copies are available on the table outside the committee room. Members have copies of all slide decks. Our first presentation this morning is going to be about Blatchley Middle School, located in my hometown of Sitka in House District 2. Before we begin, I'd like to welcome Co-Chair Story at 8:05. And Mr. White, are you on the line with us today?
On the line with you today, along with...
You broke up for a second.
I am on the line with you today.
Okay, fabulous. We have slides in front of us about Discover Your Potential 2026, but I know this is something you do regularly at Blatchley Middle School, and it goes back some time. Could you say your name for the record, and then we can advance slides if you want to tell us, and we're just going to spend about 10 minutes celebrating what you do there at Blatchley.
Yeah, that sounds great. My name is Ben White, and just so everyone knows, Assistant Principal Keith Shelton is also with me in the office here today.
Welcome. And we are on, we've just advanced to the first slide. Can you tell us about, do you have the slides in front of you, Mr. White?
No, I do not, but I can, DJ, send them to me so I can pull that up here in just a second.
So we've got the, looks like yellow eye rockfish or something.
That.
Yeah. Might be easier if you're looking at the same thing we're looking at. And just so,
sure.
Just so every, for the record, Mr. White was the boss of me for a period of time. And he survived, and so did I. So we're on the slide that has,
okay,
has kids with PFDs. Looks like they're actually out on a skiff, and they've got some rockfish.
Yeah, no. Yeah, you want me to walk you through this?
Yeah, if you could tell us what's on this slide and tell us about Discover Your Potential. Like, why? How long have you been doing it? Why do you do it? And what's so great about it?
Sure. So Discover Your Potential happens roughly every other year. There have been years we had to skip it, like during our COVID pandemic. And then there was a stretch of time we tried to do it for multiple years in a row. The kind of the birth of Discover Your Potential is about 14 years ago when we were reviewing behavioral data for the school. We realized that there is a big spike in behaviors we don't want to see during the month of February. So as well as implementing a school-wide positive behavior support program to address that, we thought we need something specifically in the month of February to kind of invigorate school, get the kids reinvested. And so that's what kind of birthed Discover Your Potential Week. It's been going, I believe this year was the 14th year. We've done it about 7 or 8 times in those 14 years. It's a conglomeration of courses offered by staff and community shareholders This picture you're seeing right here is our commercial fishing course that several kids took this year, hosted by Andrew Frisky, a fellow administrator from across the bridge at Mount Edgecombe High School. And they're able to go out and learn about boat safety, how to set gear, how to haul gear. They actually caught a bunch of crabs and had a crab feed at the end of the week. And that's just one of the many examples of classes we offer.
And we've moved to the next slide. We've got a kid in a harness.
Yes, that is our Coast Guard career. That was another example of classes we have. The USCG is always involved. They take kids over to the base and come to school, give them kind of a small sample, a small taste of what it might be like to be in the Coast Guard, and they discuss the wide variety of careers that are available to kids in the Coast Guard, and they're a very valuable partner there. They supply a lot of kind of career and educational forward-looking courses for our kids.
So, Mr. White, are the courses just what's available, or is it career-oriented, or how do you pick the courses, and who are the teachers of the courses? Because we see pasta making, welding, physical therapy, stained glass art, and how many classes do kids take, and how long does this last?
So this year we offered 50 unique courses that kids could choose from. They take four classes for 5 days in a row. They take the same four classes. So if a kid had welding as one of their classes, they'd take welding Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. The courses are offered by staff at the middle school as well as staff across Sitka School District, and then community partners. We had 35 community partners that either offered courses or offered funding or offered courses and funding to the students. We've had as many as 68 unique courses this year due to student numbers. 50 was what we could handle and still have an appropriate number of kids in each class.
And we moved ahead to the slide with the kids in the pool, talking about statistics. So has it made any difference on those February? Like when you say you were looking at behaviors, are you using this as you won't get to do DYP if you don't get your act together? Is it that?
No. It really is just meant to be a shot of fun. As well as education. You asked earlier, how do we choose the courses? It's a blend of courses that are, you know, mainly just for fun and learning something new, as well as kind of CTE and career courses. The slide we're looking at right now is offered from UAS with Joel Marcus, their scuba diver. They send over 12 scuba divers, and we put 12 kids one-on-one with them in the pool. The kids learn how to scuba dive. Yes, it has had an amazing impact, not only on our behavior, as well as implementing the school-wide behavior program. We now, our office referrals are almost non-existent compared to, we had over 400 a year 14 years ago, so a dramatic decline in those behaviors, which is what we were aiming for. As you can see here, 35 community partners this year. It's been up to 68 unique courses. One of the things to me that is the most rewarding is I frequently have kids who are now adults. When they'll see me and I haven't seen them in a year or two, the first thing they talk about is DYP. We've had several kids who are now pursuing careers from what they learned in DYP. We've got a student who's doing forensics for crime scene analysis in college. We've got another student who is pursuing a career in Hollywood makeup from our Get Gorgeous class, which is where they do gore makeup. So it's not only served the school well, but individual kids have ended up having their future shaped by what they learned during this time.
And we've just moved to the, I think, final slide, the benefits. I think that's kind of what you were talking about, the students' interest and...
Yeah.
All right. Are there any questions from the
community? Yeah, this is Hames Center, our local gym with an indoor rock climbing class we offered. 40 kids took this class. Now they know how to belay and rappel and do all the necessary things to actually do rock climbing.
And so this is something where they take two classes before lunch and two classes after lunch every day for 5 days. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Does the committee have any questions about Discover Your Potential? Rep. Dybert.
Good morning, through the chair. Thank you so much for your presentation. I didn't catch your name. I'm really sorry about that. I had just a quick question. I had a visitor in my office a couple of days ago last week mentioned that high school and middle school should have outdoor time, or like I taught third grade, so we had recess every day outside. How do you feel about high schoolers and middle schoolers having recess? Thank you.
Oh, Mr. White, what do you think about recess for middle school and high school?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because I'm an avid kickball player, and I get to hone my skills every day during recess here at Blatchley Middle School. I think it's really important, just getting outside and getting fresh air. What we have at Blatchley is a 30-minute lunch period. Kids have to eat for 10 minutes of it, and then the remaining 20 minutes of it, they can choose to go to the library and play board games or go outside and have recess, and the vast majority of kids go outside. We have several staff who supervise or chaperone recess, and we take it upon ourselves to get games going with the kids. It's also a great for kids and adults to establish relationships that are outside of the classroom norm. So I think it's not only a great brain break, great to get the blood flowing. There's a lot of research that supports, you know, movement breaks that support your brain. We've all felt that. We've sat on our computer for 45 minutes straight, and it's like your brain is turning to molasses. We get up, we go for a walk, we get a cup of coffee. That's even more important if you're 13 years old. I think it's real critical, and I think it actually serves a pretty solid educational purpose and helps kids refocus.
To clarify, are you giving the 13-year-olds coffee?
Oh, no, that is the last thing they need.
Okay, and we have a question from Representative Story, Co-Chair Story.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. Mr. White, thank you very much. Really sounds like a stellar program. My question has to do with, I can only imagine the work to coordinate all the community partners, all the planning that goes into this day. Do you have a special coordinator who arranges the different volunteers? Could you tell me a little bit about that,
Mr. White?
I will let Mr. Shelton speak to that. He was this year's coordinator, being new to DYP. The best way to learn is to dive in, so he'll answer that question.
And we're going to wrap up after his question.
Hi, this is Keith Shelton.
Welcome, Mr. Shelton.
I started back in October reaching out to community partners. Some of them were historical, like repeats, like scuba diving, and then some were new ones. So we reached out to some groups that had never helped us before and got them in. Like, there were some local chefs that came in and taught pasta class and a steak grilling class. So it was a lot of reaching out just months in advance, checking in, seeing who would need transportation. We got a metal arts class where they used one of those CNC machines to cut out metal art. So we were able to reach out to churches and get vans, and we were able to get a van from Allen Marine. So it's a lot of just figuring out transportation and people to kind of go and be with the students during that class, and community partners, who needs funding, reaching out to organizations like the Tribe or the Sinca Cruise Dock to get money to support those. So kind of balancing our wish list with what we could actually accomplish with money, transportation, time, all those types of things.
It's kind of how the legislature works. We have the wish list and then what's feasible. But I want to thank you both for taking time this morning and tell you that if you want to bring a group of kids for DYP for a week in Juneau, we'll make them pages for a day while they're here. And I want to also point out that Mr. White was spearheaded the no phones at school policy at Blatchley Middle School something like 10 years ago, where he said these things aren't good for kids. We're going to just not have them during the school day. Was that 10 years ago, Mr. White?
Yeah, probably at least. That also led to a sharp and sudden decline in office referrals because kids weren't allowed to receive inappropriate messages from other peers. So all of that conflict died down during the school day, and that's been a huge, that was a great decision we made as a staff that had a huge positive impact on our students and their ability and opportunities to learn.
And that's that local decision-making. Love it. Okay, Mr. White, Mr. Shelton, thank you so much for being with us. We are going to wrap up that portion of our meeting. And really appreciate you sharing Blatchley Middle School with us today and DYP. We are going to move on now.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity.
All right.
Thank you for the opportunity, and thank each of you for what you do for our state and our kids. Much appreciated.
All right. Have a great week at school, Mr. White.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, our next agenda item is House Bill 240 by Representative David Nelson, entitled An Act Requiring School Districts to Adopt a Digital Harassment and Non-Consensual Digital Impersonation Policy and Providing for an Effective Date. I would like to note that Deputy Director Kelly Manning from the Department of Education and Early Development is online and available for questions. Let's see, 240, yeah. And I'd like to invite Representative Nelson to come on up with his staff, Donna Page. You can introduce yourselves for the record and begin your presentation. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Good morning, everyone, to the education. Co-Chair Hemshoot, Co-Chair Story, it's great seeing you again. For the record, I am Representative David Nelson, serving Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, Government Hill, and East Anchorage. Thank you for allowing me to present House Bill 240 today. It's an act requiring school districts to adopt a digital harassment and non-consensual digital impersonation policy. As technological advances in artificial intelligence and the proliferation of social media have made clear, school children are now susceptible to new methods of bullying and harassment. Recent news coverage is full of really dark new trends emerging on social media and that expose women and children to impersonation. House Bill 240 establishes new definitions and compels school districts to create specific policies for treatments of digital harassment and non-consensual digital impersonation. School districts already have policies in place around bullying, and the legislation adds this new method of harassment to their policies. The speed at which social media platforms are creating new methods for spreading deepfakes makes this policy-enhancing legislation very urgent. Schools must have the tools for addressing digital harassment, and House Bill 240 gives them these tools. If it is the will of the committee, I will turn over to my staff, Donna Fox Page, to review the sexual analysis.
Thank you, Ms. Page.
Good morning, Chair Hemshoot and Story, and members of the House Education Committee. For the record, Donna Fox Page, staff to Representative David Nelson. Section 1 amends AS 1433-200, subsection A, to specify that each school district shall adopt a policy that addresses and prohibits digital harassment and non-consensual digital impersonation. Section 2 amends AS 1433-200, subsection C, to provide that any training materials provided must include those specifically related to digital harassment and non-consensual digital impersonation. Section 3 amends AS 1433-210 to add that each school district shall also include incidents of digital harassment and non-consensual digital impersonation to the reporting of incidents of harassment, intimidation, and bullying. Section 4 amends AS 1433-220 to add non-consensual digital harassment to the list of actions for which the section does not prohibit discipline or adverse actions against a person for false accusations. Section 5 amends AS 1433-230 to include digital harassment and non-consensual digital impersonation to the types of action for which a person is immune from damages arising from a failure to remedy a reported incident or for making the report. Section 6 amends AS 1433-250 by adding the definition of non-consensual digital impersonation, and Section 7 establishes an effective date of January 1st, 2027.
Thank you, Ms. Page. We're going to turn now to invited testimony, and I'd like to invite Alexandra to put her name on record, and because Alexandra is under 18, we will not be using a last name this morning. So, Alexandra, if you could put your name on record and give us your testimony, we are excited to hear from you.
Thank you so much, and good morning. My name is Alexandra, and I'm a high school student in Anchorage. I'm calling in today to speak about the current situation in our schools. During my time as a student, I've seen how much bullying has changed, and I truly believe our laws need to catch up with that, because bullying doesn't happen in the hallways or in the cafeteria anymore. It happens on many social media platforms like Instagram, Snapchat, or TikTok. With AI, the new technologies, students can now create fake photos, videos, and accounts that make it appear someone said or did something they never actually did. These deep fakes and fake profiles can spread in seconds, and once they're out there, it's almost impossible to undo the change fully. As a high school girl, I know how harmful this can be. Digital harassment and digital impersonation can destroy someone's reputation, seriously affect their mental health, and make them feel unsafe, even in their own home. It's not just online drama, it's real. It impacts how you walk into school the next day, how you focus in class, and how you see yourself. Other young people, I have approached Representative Nelson about these concerns because we want to make sure our schools have specific rules and real authority to handle students who use AI and social media to bully and harass others. We're not asking for anything extreme. We're asking for rules that reflect the world we actually live in. Technology is changing quickly, especially with the rise of artificial intelligence. Schools need clear tools to handle these new forms of bullying, and House Bill 240 provides that guidance. Students deserve to feel safe, not only in school buildings, but also in digital spaces that are now such a big part of our life.
Thank you so much, Alexandra. Really appreciate you being online with us this morning and giving us that perspective. I think I should turn to committee questions for both Alexandra and the bill sponsor, and then we'll go to public testimony. Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, a comment. Just yesterday, my 17-year-old son sent me a video that walked through 10 different individual people's faces saying something with the same voice, telling me very clearly that he recognizes that this is out there and you can't believe anything that you see. So obviously this happens. It's a very serious problem and issue. My question to both of you is, would you agree that this not only needs to be a school policy, but this needs to be placed in Alaska state statute for everybody?
When you say both, Rep. Schwanke, I just want to clarify, did you want Alexandra to speak to that or Representative Nelson?
Both.
Okay. Alexandra, if you're still online, do you think we need, if I understand the question correctly, not just school policy but also a state law on this issue?
Yeah.
I think it's important to get it into school policy first, but later on it would be great to do it for the state. I just think for such young students who are very impressionable, getting it done in schools and letting it be known that it's not good is important and should be first on the to-do list.
Okay, thank you very much. And Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hemshue. Through the co-chair to Representative Schwanke. Alexandra said it the best. You know, I think really this is a larger issue that needs to be tackled. But right now this is something that we can do immediately through a House bill. And then later on I think that's a larger 2 to 4 year bill that really can come in and we have a larger conversation about AI across the entire state.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Underwood.
Thank you. Through the chair, thank you for your presentation. Just want to make a comment more so. Just thank the bill sponsor for bringing this forward just in the last 72 hours. I have read and heard two different mothers' testimonies about their children no longer being with us because of AI bullying in this. So I think anything that we can do to save kids' lives and help them not ever have to go down that pathway, this is a dangerous territory that we're meddling in. So I just wanted to thank you for bringing this forward. I do think it's really important. And, I mean, I would love to see it on the state level and probably eventually, I'm sure, the federal level will have to tackle this with the rise of AI and just how to protect its citizens. So just wanted to say thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Representative Underwood. Co-Chair Story.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hemshoot. Through the chair, thank you, Representative Nelson, for bringing this bill today, and thank you, Alexandra, for your testimony. My question has to do with kind of where we are right now. And what I mean by that is I'm wondering if you have reached out to the Anchorage School District or any other school districts, how many have included this in their policies already. And at that same lines, the Alaska Associations of School Boards, they have model policies that they put out and update to groups this year. And have you had a chance to talk to them about if they've included this in a model policy for school boards to adopt?
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. And to Co-Chair Story, we've talked to a couple different people about that. We have not got anything back yet for presentation to the committee, but I imagine here shortly we will, and we'll make sure those updates are given to the entire committee. But we have talked to Commissioner Bishop mainly about their AI policy, and if they're online, I would like to punt it over to Dee to talk about what they're working on.
Thank you. Deputy Director Manning, if you're online, can you share with us what the department has in the works on this topic?
Good morning. For the record, this is Kelly Manning, Deputy Director for Division of Innovation and Education Excellence. Are you hearing me okay?
We hear you great. Good morning.
Great. Good morning. Can you repeat the question? I believe I understand it to be what are we working on in AI policy and policy around bullying, online bullying? Is that the question?
Online bullying, but also I think specifically, do we have to talk about deepfakes to really capture the bill?
Well, I mean,
Representative Nelson, what how would you state the question?
I would direct that back to Co-Chair Story for her question. But yes, I believe if her intent was correct, it would be what is the school district's policies on AI as well as bullying and digital harassment with non-consensual.
Co-Chair Story.
Yes, through the co-chair, if I may clarify the question. I'm specifically wondering what's included in this bill, digital harassment and non-consensual digital impersonation. I know that we have a anti-bullying policy statewide and districts have to have a policy in place. And I know through the discipline data they gather, they have to record which one it is, and this bill specifically names it. And I'm just wondering how far the – well, I was wondering about districts and the Association of Alaska School Boards, and then Rep. Nelson brought it to the department's level. And what do you specifically do and provide for in these areas?
Deputy Director Manning, does that clarify?
Yes. For the record, again, Kelly Manning, Deputy Director for IE. Thank you for the clarification. So I think there's a number of things. One, we do have statewide policy around bullying and harassment, and our e-learning materials that we have available are being updated to include information regarding online bullying and harassment. I can't speak to, I don't think that there's specifically language there or materials around AI harassment. I think that that's a, you know, fast changing landscape, and it's something that we're still learning how that's being used. So specific materials in that area we would still need to develop. We do last year have rolled out some statewide AI policy support and guidance, and so we have guidance for districts that can be used for creating AI policy, but again, I would say that that doesn't explicitly address use of AI for online harassment or bullying. So we do have policies in place. I think aligning to the specific area of AI, that would be something that we would need to update But those are the kinds of things that, as we look at those materials, that we're always evaluating and looking at what are the current areas of concern that need to be updated as we update those materials. Districts could speak more explicitly to how they're addressing that in their local policy. All of the work that we're doing is guidance, because we don't have a statewide policy, so it's all guidance and recommendations. So districts will be better able to speak to how they're addressing at the local level.
So, Deputy Director Manning, if I understand correctly, the department is updating their online bullying materials, but not necessarily to talk about deepfakes and impersonation. And districts are free to do that. There is no barrier to a district setting that policy. So, Rep. Nelson, if I understand correctly, this bill would say you will set a policy.
For the record, Representative David Nelson to Co-Chair Hemshute, yes, that is correct.
And my other question is, it says each district shall adopt a policy, and what the policy should address, shall specifically address, and each district shall share this policy with parents or guardians, so through the handbook or whatever. And so this is different than shall adopt a policy, and here is a policy that they could adopt. Like, you're not suggesting the policy, you're just saying that they must address it.
For the record, Representative David Nelson to Co-Chair Hemshute. Yes, the intent is to have as much local control as possible. For my district, the high school, my district, Bartlett High, it's a lot different than a high school you find out in Sitka or out in Fairbanks or anywhere else across Alaska. So I want to have their local control to be able to work on what they see best fits.
Okay. We have a question from Representative Dybert.
Good morning. Thank you through the chair to Representative. Thank you for bringing this forward. I know I've been out of the class for a couple of years, but when we did online learning, I was constantly educating my students on behaving online, and it's important. That was even down to third grade, so a lot of education begins in this area. My question is, and maybe Deputy Director might be able to answer this, is the state providing any, what is their program that they're paying, are we paying for any kind of program that districts can feed off of? Thank you.
I think that question's for the department. So Deputy Director Manning, is there anything that is paid for by the state of Alaska to help districts with this issue?
Good morning. For the record, again, this is Kelly Manning, Deputy Director for IEE. We don't have a statewide training or materials explicitly that are provided to districts. We do have some online materials that are available, and I can get some information on how those are being used and shared with districts, and I can follow up with more on that.
Okay. That would be great, I think. And we'll go now to Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hemshute. Through the chair to Representative Nelson, thank you for being here, and thank you for bringing this bill forward. My last year teaching was 2015, and online harassment was a thing back then. So, but with new tools now, obviously, 10 years hence. The question I have is, I understand that this is for local control. Each school district under this bill would set its own policy, but I'm kind of interested more in the definition of digital harassment. My experience has been it's been posts made by students harassing others directly, but would something as simple as a emoji response be a digital reaction or a harassment? I just want to get more context of what that definition is again.
Yeah.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. For the record, Representative David Nelson, through the chair to Representative Eichheit. In the bill, we really only have the definition of non-consensual digital impersonation on there, mainly because elsewhere in state statutes are definitions for what you have been alluding to and talking about.
Follow up
through the co-chair. Do you have that just at top of mind?
No, but we could through the chair to Representative Eichheit, for the record, David Nelson, Representative David Nelson. No, but we can get back to you offline with that.
Thank you.
If I may, Co-Chairs, I'd like to point to Section 6 of the bill.
Ms. Page, for the record, could you put your name on record?
For the record, Donna Fox Page, staff to Representative David Nelson. Section 6 of the bill does actually add some of those definitions, particularly materially represents the appearance, speech, or behavior of an individual in a way that changes the fundamental character of the individual's appearance, speech, or behavior. So we have addressed sort of more specifically impersonation of a person. So an emoji I don't think would fit into that definition.
And I think Representative Eichheit was asking about the other part, which is digital harassment broadly. And, you know, there are certain emojis that mean something different than the fruit or whatever that the emoji is. Not going into a lot of detail on that, but is that considered harassment or whatever at that point? So I think that would need some clarification. Okay, and I think we can go ahead and go to public testimony. We're going to open public testimony. And I don't think we have anybody in the room to testify. And I don't see anyone online. So with that, we're going to close public testimony on House Bill 240. And if there are no more questions on House Bill 240, I think we'll just... Okay, I think we do have one more question from Representative Dybert.
Thank you, through the chair. One final comment. I'm still processing all the information here. My question, Representative Nelson, is I know these are first for children, can you know, 0 through 18. Have you looked into, like, freedom of speech when it's online, if that's going to affect this? Or have you looked into that at all? Thank you.
For the record, Representative David Nelson, through the chair to Representative Dybert, no, that is not something we have looked into.
Follow up. Just something to look into and what other states are doing, because it is something that we have our... What we post online, we could post online, and which is terrible, but we do have that freedom. Thanks.
Thank you. And Co-Chair Story.
Thank you. Through the chair, I want to really thank you for this policy. I think it's really important. I think that there's some work to do on just, which I'm hoping we can do by next time you present, to really bring back the information that we talked about, because I think when I think about harassment, is it like one instance? Is it a repeated, targeted? There's just so many things that I think we want to make sure are included in the bill or addressed in some way through a policy. So it'd be great to see some of the policies that perhaps already exist out there. Again, I don't know if ASB has a model policy on this. If they don't, hopefully it'll spur them to get one, because this is just, this is something that strikes at the heart of what's happening, as we heard from our fellow committee members this morning. And so I really hope we can even hear from maybe your district in Anchorage what they are doing on this model, because we know right now, as sure as we're sitting here, they're dealing with it. And children are feeling the ramifications from it, and I'm sure there are adult teachers and staff and everyone is aware, and parents, and trying to cope with it right now. So again, thank you very much for bringing this bill forward.
I think that's kind of that fine line that we have to walk too, is so now if schools don't have cell phones in school, then is it the school's problem when this happens and it's not happening at school? And of course it is, because the kids are in school dealing with whatever's happening outside of school. Like, we never, school is not a silo. We're not isolated in the school. The things outside the school impact what's happening in the school. So this is tricky territory, but I think really important for us to have the conversation. So with that, I think it'd be great to hear back from, get some more information, and we're going to set the bill aside for now and look forward to the next hearing. So thank you, Ms. Page, and thank you, Representative
thank
Nelson,
you.
For your time this morning, for bringing us this bill. We're going to take a quick at ease to figure out the next item for the committee. So at ease. Okay, we're back in order here, and we're going to move around in the agenda a little bit and go forward to House Bill 261 while we wait for the sponsor of House Bill 246 to arrive. We'd asked him to come at 9. So we have a good 15 minutes. We're going to use those 15 minutes. Our next order of business is House Bill 261, sponsored by Representative Story, relating to average daily membership and school funding. The committee has previously heard invited testimony on this bill. At this point, the Department of Education and Early Development has provided an updated fiscal note, which has been provided to members, and the department is available. Oh, and the fiscal note is available online. I'd like to note that Lori Weed is also here and available for questions. Lori is the Department of Education School Finance Manager. And Representative Story and Tammy, could you go ahead and introduce yourselves for the record and begin?
Thank you, Co-Chair Himshud. For the record, Representative Andy Story, representing District 3, which is North Juneau, Mendenhall Valley, Ritz Cove, Hawk Bay, Out the Road, Haynes, Skagway, Cluckwan, and Gustavus. Oh.
Good morning, Co-Chair Himshud and committee. I am Tammy Smith, staff to Representative Story.
Thank you. Thanks for being here, and we're looking for the update. What have we learned?
Thank you, Co-Chair Himshud. I was really hoping that we could have Lori Weed talk a little bit about the fiscal note. I had asked in the fiscal note to break the fiscal note out by the different components for what the bill contains, because we had added things such as the alternative high schools. We had added intensive needs factor. And I was hoping, since she, in working for the number, to see how to get to it. And so I've asked Ms. Weed for that, and I don't know if that's something she feels she can't provide, but I was hoping we could have her go through the fiscal note, and then we can ask her some questions about how she came to those numbers. And I also wanted to say that I don't know if everyone got page 3 where it broke down by districts. Did everyone get that? Okay, good. I was looking. And is it on basis? Because when I was looking at it last night, I have all 3 pages, and it looked like there was just 2 up. So hopefully we can check on that.
Okay, we'll confirm that all 3 are on basis. And so you'd like Ms. Weed just to talk through the fiscal notes, or is there a specific question?
I would just like to know on the record how Ms. Weed came up with the $147 million, I am guessing. And then my other big question was asking if right now a lot of the districts are in hold harmless, and so this bill takes away the hold harmless. And so I'm wondering what we were spending on the hold harmless, and then we have the $147 million. I would think we would be minusing whatever we're spending now on hold harmless to have a smaller amount of the cost of the bill. But I just wanted to make sure that I'm understanding that correctly, and I certainly think Ms. Weed can help me and everyone else understand the fiscal note.
Ms. Weed, if you're online, could you please put your name on record and discuss hold harmless and also anything that you'd like to add about how this fiscal note was calculated?
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, Chair, Co-Chair Himshut, Representative Story, and members of the House Education Committee. For the record, my name is Lori Weed, and I serve as the School Finance Manager for the Department of Education and Early Development. So as to how the fiscal note was calculated, we did have to generate new ADM numbers. So obviously we're taking the previous three-year average as defined in the bill and comparing those to this year's preliminary count for FY26. And for the fiscal note, that is what we generated the numbers on. So each individual school gets compared to its three-year average or the preliminary count, find the greater of, and that's come through the district's total for school sizes adjustments and then it gets plugged into the formula. I would like to note that it is being compared to the FY27 projections. So if we were to compare it to, say, the preliminary FY26 numbers, those would also be a different, you know, it's a different comparison because we're comparing the different fiscal years, different number methodologies. It does get a little confusing just for a like-to-like comparison. I know, Rep Story, you were particularly interested in, say, like the alternative program component amount. That's a good example to just how this bill, you know, with the different changes and how the choosing of the ADM in the beginning can affect the different calculations. So for alternative programs, like, it's hard to say what exactly the amount is because compared to FY27, it's going to be different. We're going to be, with the removal of the minimum ADM for an alternative program, that's also reducing the school that the ADM previously was going in. And then whatever number is used for that school size obviously impacts as well. But for this particular component, as I ran the scenario, I can say it's approximately $5.8 million for changing the school size adjustment. If there are other questions, particular pieces, I can try to break them out. I would have to run some different information and get back to the committee most likely.
Okay, looking to the committee for questions or Co-Chair Story, I have a question. I'm still confused, Ms. Weed, and I probably just need this in single syllables, but I'm confused at why it would cost more, I guess, because if we, so with the exchange of hold harmless basically for the three-year average, as you calculated this, you calculated it according to what a district would choose. So you had to go to each of the 53 districts, look at their three-year average, and look at their current year count, figure out which was higher, apply that, and that results in a net addition of funding. Is that correct?
Or to the chair, Lori Weed. So we actually look at the school level, not just at the district level. And then, yes, we'll take the greater of either the previous 3 years or the current count and then look at that comparison and pick whichever is greater and then run the school size adjustment from there. And that definitely, you know, that starts at usually a larger increase because you're taking the higher number and then run the school size adjustment. And for some districts, they're maybe on track, they will end up losing funding at that point, absent hold harmless, because either the hold harmless was previously in effect or they're starting fresh from a 5% school size drop. And it very much is district dependent, school dependent.
Okay, and then I have a follow-up question to that, and that is on the intensive needs kids. It would be so much easier to understand this if we had a fiscal note for each component of the bill. I don't know if that would be possible to get, but when it comes to the intensive needs sort of recalculation in February, in theory, the number of intensive needs kids is unlikely to grow by a great deal. So it's just a matter of where are those kids. But I guess the funding would be in the original October count, that funding would remain in place, and if an intensive needs kid moved to a different district, they would then also receive that funding. Is that how this bill works in your interpretation? And so would it be possible to get fiscal notes for each section of the bill? It would be easier for me to understand or even to think about amending the bill if I knew that it's going to cost this much to do the intensive recalculation, or it's going to cost this much to do the alternative school section. Is it possible to get the fiscal notes in, like, separated out in that way? I guess is my question. There were a lot of questions in there, but let's make that the question I'm asking right now.
Chair Hemshute, Lori Weed, it is very difficult to break out the individual components because it is very dependent on the calculation that happens in the beginning. So when we can break out a scenario, but it wouldn't be, you know, there's not only one right scenario when you're running it. And we can certainly provide a scenario to give an idea of how it interplays. Intensives in specifically are kind of a standalone item, so that one is easy to break out, and that I have run, and it is approximately $43 million to take the greater of the prior three-year average or the current October count.
For just that section of the bill dealing with the intensive needs students, that's $43 million?
Correct.
Interesting. Okay. We have a – oh, and I wanted to confirm all three pages are on basis, so everything is there. Representative Schwanke, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I just, you know, because I had asked for that as well at the last hearing, getting it broken down by component of the bill, but – maybe what you can do for us is take one of the districts that saw a large increase in the projected cost of the state and then take one of the districts that sees a fairly large decrease in the projected cost of the state and kind of walk through those calculations for us, potentially provide that to the committee.
Ms. Weed?
Through the chair, Representative Schwanke. Yes. Again, with the caveat that breaking it down slightly differently may get a slightly different result, but I will provide a scenario of each.
Okay. Any other questions for Ms. Weed? Co-Chair Story?
Yes, thank you. And I do understand that this is a analysis at one point in time, knowing that it will change, and I do understand that to get to the 147 million fiscal note, you had to take what those components at a place in time. So it'd be just great to see what those calculations were. I wanted to say that the second question I asked was, what would be the difference? The hold harmless provision is in effect now, and how much is that costing us now? How much would that be? Go away if this bill came into effect where we were using the three-year averaging.
And I thought I heard $5.8 million, but Ms. Weed, can you answer that question? Can we calculate the expense of hold harmless?
To Chair Hemshute, Co-Chair Story, Lori Weed for the record, I did ask my staff to run that this morning, so I haven't it hasn't been double-checked, but it looks like the current hold harmless provisions cost as a state aid cost about $12
million. Okay. Co-Chair Story.
Yes. Just wanted – so the $5.8 million was the alternative school.
That was the alternative schools?
Well, I just wanted to verify that because that seems kind of high, but I wanted to verify that through the chair. With Ms. Weed, if possible.
Ms. Weed, can you clarify?
Through the chair of Rep Story, Lori Weed, yes. 5.8 was for the alternative program.
Okay. Thank you for that. Rep Hemshute, if I might comment.
Yes.
Yes. And again, knowing that $5.8 million really, I believe, should be going to the alternative high schools. I'm trying to think if there's 16 of them. I can't remember. Or 12. And again, they are running a school on the school size factor that smaller schools do get typically, but alternative schools, again, are attached to the larger size high school. And the students in the alternative schools, by nature, have some complex needs and need some wraparound services. So that is really good to know what that component is. So I appreciate that. I wanted to say I've had quite a few conversations about the fiscal notes from a couple of districts who reached out to me who lost revenue. And I can think of one school district where, like, they have around 80-some kids, and if you lose four students, that is about $300,000 or maybe more. I'm not remembering the exact, but it's a significant amount of money. And so they see, and they were in hold harmless, and so they can see why they would. When you, having a small school is a very delicate thing, because as you know, we base the district's budget on the number of students that we have. And so that's triggers a 5% drop, losing four students if you're around 80 student. And so losing that in the first year is significant. And how do you recover from losing $300,000? And so suggestions have been districts currently in hold harmless. And on this fiscal note, there's seven of them. And we'd have to verify if all of those were truly in hold harmless. You would maybe want to consider, do you want to grandfather those students, those districts in? And again, do we need to have a special component for our unique rural small schools in our state that have a certain amount of operation that you need to have? So so I think that we really have to ask ourselves about how we are doing our policy for funding education in the state. Is it important that we provide stability by giving districts the number before the school year starts? And is that, you know, truly the benefit that we need to provide stability in the system as we go forward, and not doing this chaotic backwards funding where we're causing all the stress, we can't retain teachers, you know, the three district averaging or the prior year, like I said, is common in other states. And once you get on that track, is that what we want to do in the state of Alaska, so we're not backwards funding and districts are knowing the number beforehand? So I think it's we could have our three-year averaging could be one that was very proactive and supportive of districts if we took into every kind of situation our smaller schools. So we'll have to really be thinking about this, and I'm really pleased that we did get the fiscal notes, and I'm pleased that we can have it break it down to components. And I would have a couple more questions, if I might, with Ms. Weed on the record.
Okay, and then I think we'll need to move on in about, like, maybe do those questions, and then we're going to take a quick Eddie's to talk about what to do next with this bill, and then in a couple of minutes we'll move on to the next bill. So co-chair Story.
Yes, I just a question. Was this fall OASIS data used for the ADM calculation? So that's one of the questions I had.
Ms. Weed?
Yes, through the chair, Lori Weed, Rep. Story. The preliminary fall FY26 data was used as the, quote, prior year count. So FY20. 3, 4, and 5 were used for the average.
Okay, thank you for that. And then just a couple of other comments I wanted to make, and then I realize Rep. Joseph is here, is when I'm looking at the fiscal note, I expected the fiscal note to be higher, because right now we are giving districts, when you do the three-year averaging, people are getting support for the 1%, 2%, 3%, 4% loss of enrollment. You know, they're not waiting to the fifth year of enrollment, and we are in a more of a declining enrollment, you know, environment. And again, it's not unique to the state of Alaska. It's across the nation with less children, many things happening. So, I do think wholeheartedly that we need to think about budgeting, which provides stability for our districts and for our communities, and building that confidence in our policy for public schools, so funding policy for public schools. So
thank you, Co-Chair Story, and thanks for the conversation this morning, Ms. Weed. We're going to take a brief at ease. Andy, we had an amendment. We're back on record, and we are now going to set House Bill 261 aside to be taken up at a later date. Thank you, Co-Chair Story and Tammy, for your presentation this morning, and Ms. Weed for being online to walk us through those fiscal notes. And at this point, we are going to take up House Bill 246 with Representative Josephson. If Representative Josephson and his staff person will come forward and put your names on record and tell us about House Bill 246.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is year 14 for me, and I don't think I've appeared before this committee before. My name is Andy Josephson. I represent House District 13 in South Midtown Anchorage, and we appreciate your calendaring the bill before you, House Bill 246. This bill would increase the rate that exists right now for CESA, the Special Education Service Area, and make an inflation adjustment, and we want to explain why we think this is worthy and important to do. The legislature created CESA in 1986 to help it administer a low-incidence disability program, principally for rural Alaska, not exclusively, but principally, and use funds also, along with this fee, for given from the federal government to comply with the Individual Disabilities Education Act of 1975. The agency is governed by the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. It has its own boards as well. It has experts, a couple dozen of them. We have its director here, Ms. Yancey, and she can give you more specifics. But it provides itinerant outreach services for special education students who are in need of special education because of disabilities like deafness, deaf-blind disability, intellectually disabled persons, developmentally disabled persons, hearing impaired, blind and visually impaired, orthopedically disabled, health impaired, severely emotionally disturbed, and students with multiple disabilities. These are situations where the need occurs infrequently. As I said, it's a low-incidence disability, but the services are vital. These would be services that are provided in areas that where they can't normally be provided, partly because of the location and the cost, and hence the response to rural need in particular. Also, situations where the service cannot be easily provided by local school district personnel because of the low number of students in the district. Again, that's where CESA comes in. CESA also operates the following three programs in particular: the Alaska Autism Resource Center, the Alaska Deafblind Project, and the Alaska Center for Accessible Materials. I took some time recently to read through a 2020 audit. It was the last audit of CESA, and they do remarkable work. They received very high marks in their audit for compliance with notice and their statutory duties and fulfillment of their mission statement and all of those sorts of things. You have a fiscal note before you that comes as no surprise. It comes in the exact figure we anticipated. And so that's what this is. You'll see that it's a very short bill because we're changing the number. And by the way, importantly, this number needs adjustment because of an increase in student population that needs that have these needs, the ones I've described, as well as inflation. This need was brought to me by a Mr. Savelle, who works with the council, last year. It could have been. It's one of those things. You're all very familiar with this because of the BSA debate, we'll call it. but it could have been dealt with as an appropriation measure or as a statutory measure with a fiscal note. We've decided on the latter pathway. With that, if there are no questions, or if there are questions, I can answer them, but I encourage you to hear from Ms. Yancey.
And before we go to Ms. Yancey, I want to let everyone know that we have – I hope I'm getting this right. We have two invited testifiers today. Okay. And then we have Mr. Seville online for questions, as well as Genevieve Hall. Mr. Seville is with the Governor's Council for Disabilities and Special Education. We have Genevieve Hollins online for questions. She's the business manager for CESA. And we have Deb Riddle, the operations manager at DEED for, I think, for special education services. And so those folks are all online for questions. And I think we'll go to our invited testifiers right now and start with Ms. Yancey, and then we'll take committee questions after invited testimony. Ms. Yancey, if you're online, could you please put your...
Oh, she's in the room.
Sorry.
Yep.
Ms. Yancey, if you could come forward. And I think, did we not have a presentation on CESA last year in this committee?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we did. So that's, I'm sure that's still back out on basis if you want to find that. Sorry, I didn't recognize you. Welcome. And if you could put your name on record and begin your testimony. We're glad you're here this morning. Thank you.
Good morning, House Education Committee. Thank you for your time. For the record, my name is Olivia Yancey, the CESA Executive Director of Special Education Service Agency. And I hope that Jean Gerhardt Cyrus, our CESA Board Chair, is also online, and Genevieve Hollins for questions. About us, as described by Representative Josephson, we are an education service agency. We have those services available with a team of special education teachers dedicated to providing supports, building local capacity within rural school districts, with an average of 13 years of teaching experience or consulting experience. As you can see, our team has been in Alaska for a number of years, but just for this fiscal year, we have provided with the Low Incidence Disability Services 2,661 participants, which is our school team members, services 15 minutes or more, which covers 49 school districts. For the Alaska Deafblind Project, if you lump them in, 51 school districts. Some additional information, we've had 495 students served with a caseload of 436 active students. We do serve correspondence programs. Currently, we have 17 that are listed on our caseload as of now. And we have an active caseload with the autism program of 176 students and a current wait list of 7 students waiting in their teams for some support. Our second highest program has 133 students receiving services close to a wait list, followed by the emotional disabilities program at 59 students, the deaf and hard of hearing at 24, the vision impairment program at 28, and the deafblind program at 16. Funding for CESA primarily is held with the state of Alaska. As you can see, there's two programs that are receiving funding directly from the state of Alaska, the LID programs, along with Alaska Autism Resource Center. The Alaska Autism Resource Center also receives some federal pass-through state, along with the Alaska Center for Accessible Materials and a direct federal piece for the Alaska Deafblind Project. We also have a committed fund balance that is also receiving some interest in some other mini grants that we've written for to provide support for our students. What does CESA's consultations look like? Here we have three specialists working, two on site and one in our statewide lending library. One specialist is currently observing a student accessing their educational environment through a brailler. They are learning how to braille, and that's the first image. Angel Black, our teacher for the visually impaired, observing a student in the southeast. We have a teacher for multiple disabilities observing a student doing a pre-vocational task. She's also collaborated with our vision specialist to look at making this vocational task accessible with the black contrast and preferential seating. And then we have John Barrowman, our autism specialist. who is looking at materials for communication as well as life skills. We have a Go Talk 4 from the library to check out, which also saves school district funds to check something like that out to see if that works for communication, along with things like life skills materials. There's a model teeth and a visual timer and a self-help book on life skills for students with autism. He's planning on bringing that out, or he did bring that out to site for the school district to check out, but then it also saves the state or school district funds. We ask the teams that we work with whether or not they've gained knowledge as a result of this service, and for the past three school years, survey results, majority say yes. Our CESA trainings can look very different depending on the request, as well as the topic. Specialists travel pretty much everywhere, whether it's at in-house. This image to the left is of Lion Johnson. He's actually in Sitka, offering a in-service training on emotional, social-emotional learning. The image to the right is of a laptop with Angel Black, our moderator, Dr. Susan Bashinsky, and an interpreter offering a webinar series for students that have deaf blindness and social-emotional learning. These are offered free to anyone that would like to participate. Often it's first come, first serve. So the big concern, as stated earlier by Representative Josephson, is that we are seeing an increase in referrals to our services at the Education Service Agency. Again, it's a low incidence population, but we're seeing an increase in referrals, which is a good thing. That means they're receiving some evidence-based practices, but we're also seeing that our funding is tied to average daily membership of the year before, which is slightly decreasing, which then also means we lose funds as a result of this. Another snapshot of our funding. The one image to the top left corner is Fund 100, which is what we use to describe the Low Incidence Disabilities General Fund. The one thing I wanted to point out was the change listed on the second line item for State of Alaska. Last year, we lost $35,700 due to average daily membership changing. And the image to the right is our budget allotted for the Low Incidence Disabilities Program. And the one thing to highlight is that the majority of the funds we receive from the state of Alaska go to hire special education teachers with this practice and this skill set. And they travel directly to those rural and rural remote communities. So the big ask is to change per the fiscal note to $26.89. What does that give CESA? An opportunity to increase our special education teacher team and compensate for some of the inflation costs for cost of living for our teachers. And I don't know if Jean Gerhardt-Cyrus is online, but if she is, I'd welcome her testimony if that's allowed.
Thank you very much. Before we move to Ms. Gerhardt-Cyrus, are there questions for Ms. Yancey? Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Yancey, just kind of a basic question. Can you describe to the committee and members what the relationship is between the services that CESA provides and the special education contracts that every district has? If they don't have therapist staff, they all have contracts with PT, OT, speech. Can you describe how you work with that?
Yancey.
Through the chair, Representative Schwanske, that's a great question. We are not a direct service provider, so we don't offer direct services or quarterly reports on IEPs. Instead, we are established to build the local capacity. So how we work with contractors, such as related service providers, is often they don't have the knowledge base to work with someone with such a unique need. And so often, for example, our LID multiple disabilities team is involved in providing coaching related to feature assessments for augmentative and alternative communication devices. So oftentimes we have speech-language pathologists or therapists that don't know how to feature match a AAC device to a student. And so they will work with CESA specialists to go through that process.
All right, thank you.
That's fine. Okay, great. Any other questions from the committee? Co-Chair Story.
Thank you, through the chair, and thank you for being here today. I remember reading, and I'm trying to find out what the wait list was for CESA right now. I don't know if I missed that slide, but I would find that information helpful.
Thank you, Chair Story. The wait list currently is 6 students under the Low Incidence Disabilities Autism Program. We've had 14 total for that particular program this school year. We've been able to manage due to students graduating or students relocating to a different area, being able to meet the other 7 students. But as of now, our specialists are maxed out. There's 40 students and their school teams per specialist. And then last year, we had a wait list of 19 students spread across 2 programs, the LID Multiple Disabilities Project and the LID Autism Program.
Follow-up? Thank you, through the chair. So what that means to me is I know federally we are required and we want to meet every child's needs so they can get the support services they need to be as strong as they can be. So I'm assuming then that means whatever district has the wait list that they are having to, through their funds, try and hire or contract with whatever that child's needs are. So I can assume that there's some cost to a district somewhere, or else I don't want to assume that child is not getting their needs met, but unfortunately that might be happening.
Yancy, can you talk about wait lists?
Absolutely. We have an average, last year was an average of 2 months for a student to wait to be added to our programs. This year, that is not the case. We have 7 students that are waiting and will be indefinite. Unfortunately, having been a specialist myself, there may be times where a student would not receive contract services. I think that the uniqueness and the specials, I'm very passionate about this program. We're kind of the frontline special education teachers that are advocating for things like sensory loss. And so oftentimes we're building capacity by building awareness of the need. So teams may say, yes, we need some support, but we don't know exactly what we need. And so to contract with a special education teacher, they may not know exactly what to be asking for in said contract.
Thank you. Comment?
Yeah, of course.
So what I see very much through this bill is in the fiscal note required here, we actually are, again, meeting students' needs and helping train our teachers to be as effective as possible to help those students gain the skills they need. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Yancey. And I think we'll move now to our other invited testifier, Jean Gerhardt Cyrus. Could you please put your name on record and begin your testimony?
Thank you to the chairs and members of the committee for having me. My name for the record is Jean Gerhardt Cyrus. I have served on the Special Education Service Agency Board for about 10 years and as the chair since 2019. I have been a member of the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education for nearly 15 years, but perhaps the most important role I represent today is that of a parent. I live in Kiana, a village above the Arctic Circle, about 60 miles upriver from Kotzebue, accessible by air. Rural reality shapes everything about education and access to services. I'd like to share some information about my personal experience with CESA. My daughter has given her permission for me to share our story, and some of you may have met her as she advocated for the restraint and seclusion bill passage. My daughter struggled with significant behavioral challenges as a result of prenatal exposure. The school often asked, "What's going on at home?" The reality was we were able to meet her needs at home. My husband and I are both retired special education teachers, and because of this, we knew she was not being served appropriately at school. She had a classroom aide and a classroom teacher and a special education teacher, but neither was trained to recognize or respond to her behaviors. And as a result, they were seen as non-compliance requiring discipline rather than signs that she needed support and accommodations. Starting in pre-K, I was called to school on a regular basis. She was sent home on a regular basis. She was also restrained and secluded on a regular basis. Because of a lack of available expertise, my daughter was denied an appropriate education, and we could not get the support we needed. Staff were unaware of how to meet her needs. My daughter is bright and has behavioral needs. Eventually, she was provided with a one-to-one aid. However, we were still receiving regular calls to come in school, to school and take her home. She was ostracized and kept from the very place she most wanted to be, which was school. As a student, she had as much right to an education as any other student, but teachers were unaware of how to provide that education to her. The teachers themselves were frustrated, falling back on their own training. The help that was needed was not available. We worked with the school, the district, and eventually with the Disability Law Center. We began working with CISA when my daughter was in elementary school. I remember the specialist first time asking what we wanted for our daughter. It was welcome and it was simple. We wanted her educated. To be educated, she needed to be in school. CISA support helped school staff understand her disability-related needs and establish accommodations and plans that worked. They provided guidance, support, and follow-through and helped ensure the services were implemented. They supported the school and our family, and ultimately and most importantly, my daughter. Ultimately, my daughter graduated. Even earning college credits by graduation. Without CISA, we would have proceeded to resolution to ensure her rights were safeguarded. As a former teacher, I and my former students would have benefited from access to CISA as well. Alaska districts are struggling to find classroom and special education teachers, and even more so specialists. As populations decrease, so do funds and the number of teacher positions. The need for CISA services increases. CISA services ensure that districts can meet their legal obligation to appropriately educate all students. CISA specialists provide the expert support and guidance to staff to enable them to meet student needs effectively. They work with teachers, principals, parents, and paraprofessionals. And the paraprofessionals are often the people who serve the same students throughout their entire education process. CISA also helps staff understand the low-incidence disabilities. Students who experience these disabilities may be undiagnosed, and even when a child doesn't have a formal diagnosis, CISA provides training both online and in person, access to materials through lending library, and connections to additional resources. CISA builds long-term capacity. When CISA works with a school team focused on one student, the staff gains skills that help them support future students as well. This is how rural schools grow stronger over time. They are not only serving students, they are strengthening entire school systems. CISA is fortunate to have highly committed specialists in leadership. We are always looking for ways to improve effectiveness and efficiency to better serve students. CISA is essential. It is a lifeline for families, schools, and students across rural Alaska. Without it, many students would not receive the services they need, which is their legal right, and families and districts would be forced into conflict resolution process simply to ensure free and appropriate education for our students. I thank you for hearing us out and for your support, Representative Josephson, and I thank you for this opportunity to share my insight.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gearhart Cyrus. What a journey. Are there any questions for Ms. Gearhart Cyrus from the committee? Okay, seeing no questions from the committee, we're going to, and are there any, I guess we already did questions for Ms. Yancey, so I think we can go to public testimony at this point. So I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify? And is there anyone online wishing to testify? I don't see anybody online either. So seeing no one in the room or online wishing to testify, I'm going to close public testimony on this bill. And if there's no further discussion on the bill, are there any other last questions or discussion? I had one question for the bill sponsor.
Yes, Madam Chair.
I hope this question is for you. I might be placing the question in the wrong place. I have a document here showing, it's a table showing CESA's funding formula, and there's CESA funding rate was $15.75 for many years, and then the funding rate changed in 2014 to $18.65 for several years, and then in 2023 it changed to $23.13. Were those statutory changes? So the last time we changed their rate was in 2023, I guess is the question.
To the chair, I was looking at the statute this morning, and that is a statutory rate, yes.
Okay.
So I'm imagining what the chair is thinking about that. And all I can tell you is that writ large, the legislature has been receptive to making adjustments when they've been sought. Unlike other adjustments.
We are well aware that what the need is and what the legislature does don't always match. So I just wanted to make sure. So the bill then would change that rate again. It's that.
To the chair, that is right.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions for the bill sponsor? Representative Schwanke?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rep. Josephson, I'm just kind of curious, on that same table, actually, the CESA funding formula, are these just brick-and-mortar enrollments? Does this include the statewide correspondence numbers as well?
I think for that, I've got the perfect person to answer, and that's Ms. Yancey.
Yeah, I think the document came from Ms. Yancey. So if you could come forward and put your name on record and help us with that question.
Through the chair to Representative Schwanske, the average daily membership is the five-pager that we receive at the end of this month for public school average daily membership. And so that number, I would believe homeschool is part of public school, but I don't know if exactly the answer to that question. We do serve correspondence programs.
No, that's good. Thank you.
Great. And then next in the queue we have Representative Dybert, and then Representative Story.
Good morning, through the co-chair. Thank you to the representative. Thank you for bringing this forward. I know as an educator that any kind of assistance with helping our students in the classroom and this program providing that, especially out in rural Alaska, when it comes to special needs students, I guess I don't really have a question, just that, especially in rural Alaska when we have, J1 teachers who are coming here to help teach our students, the support is probably immensely appreciated because moving to Alaska and, you know, not stepping into these tough roles. So I just thank you for that. And welcome to the Education Committee. Rep. Josephson.
Thank you, Rep. I appreciate it very much.
Okay, and Co-Chair Story.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hemshute. I wanted to go back to the page you referenced with the statute changed and seen it changed in 2023. And if you look at the count period right above that where they had the same rate for 10 years, it has to do with when they were the audit, and then at the time of the audit, close to that, in order to continue CESA, Senate President Stevens had a bill to continue the program and do the statutory increase at the time. And I had the opportunity to carry that bill on the House side. And at that time when we picked the number, we thought that number, you know, may be adequate for 10 years, hard to know. And then, of course, we have seen unprecedented inflation, and we have seen a rise in the needs of our children. and youth. And so it is, I'm glad that CESA is coming forward when they see the need. It's up to them to let us know when we have a need in this area. And I know that it is a legal obligation that we have. It also is a federal legal obligation to pay for our, through the IDEA, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. When that was passed, the federal government was going to pay 40% of that bill, and they are right about 12 or 13% right now. And there is a glide path bill in the House of Representatives. They've had a similar bill for several years where they will increase the amount of funding in Congress till they get to the 40%. I actually have a resolution that I'm hoping this committee will consider being a committee bill and resolution that we ask Congress to fully fund the IDEA Act. And anyway, because it is so important that we save dollars, because when we help everyone reach their full potential, they contribute so much. And so I just wanted to say thank you. And I did want to say also that I serve on the Governor's Council of Disabilities and Special Education, and so I'm aware of the need, and I know the council fully supports this increment.
I think the bottom line is, I'm just going to make my own comment here, is that the CESA funding is tied to public school enrollment, which is down, and yet we can see on the low incident disability count number that those numbers have climbed. So being funded on a declining curve when the need is on an inclining curve is the problem that we're trying to solve for today. So it makes perfect sense to me that the need is far greater than what current funding is taking care of. And when I hear wait list, my heart breaks. So thank you, Rep. Josephson, for bringing this bill. If there are no further questions, we're going to set this bill aside. Okay. Wait a minute. Are we? No, I think we'll set an amendment deadline. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. We're going to go ahead and set an amendment deadline for House Bill 246. It's a very straightforward bill. At noon on Friday, February 27th, please submit all amendments to my office by that time. And now we will set House Bill 246 aside to be taken up at a later date.
Thank you
very much, Mr. Alper, Representative Josephson, Ms. Yancey, and everyone online who is available for questions. Thank you for being with us today. That is going to wrap up our meeting for today. I'd like the committee to note that we are finishing on time or early. Happy Monday. Our next meeting is this Wednesday, February 25th at 2026. The House Finance Subcommittee for the Department of Education and Early Development will begin at 8 and will adjourn at 9, after which this committee will gavel in to hear presentations on career and technical education and career guides. Invited testifiers on this subject include representatives from the Department of Education and Early Development, Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and Zach Stenson with Pathfinder Solutions. If time allows, we will hear bills previously heard. And as a reminder, the committee's email address for anyone wishing to reach the committee is house.education@akledge.gov. That's akleg.gov. Public testimony can be sent to this address. And seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 9:38 a.m.